Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Wednesday, July 20th, 2016. I am Noah Rothman, and with me is Commentary Magazine senior editor Abe Greenwald. Hi, Abe.
Hi, Noah.
Unfortunately, John Podhoretz is not with us right now. He is in Cleveland, where the Republican Party has just officially and formally nominated Donald Trump to be their presidential candidate in 2016, where he will likely go head-to-head against likely Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton in November. The process by which Donald Trump finally won the nomination was, as you've been following along, a pretty divisive one. It pitted the party against each other. It sowed a lot of divisions, and those divisions were exposed over the course of this week. In the convention was supposed to be a really unifying event, a calm, cathartic event in which bygones are let go and everybody joins hands and sings Kumbaya. There wasn't a ton of that to be seen on, particularly on the week preceding this convention, when the Rules Committee met, the Platform Committee as well, and on day one and day two of this nominating process, which resulted in Donald Trump's nomination. What we saw in both cases were efforts by anti-Trump forces to upend the process or at least stage a little bit of a revolt, sort of just an attempt to show that there was a lack of unity behind Donald Trump, and they wanted to make a perhaps an ill-fated case for why he shouldn't be the nominee. And in just about every case, the forces that were arrayed against Donald Trump were going to lose. They were modest. They were poorly organized. They didn't have the numbers that they needed. And the RNC could have made real big fools of them in every case. And in every case, the RNC played their hand really poorly and made a martyr of the anti-Trump forces. And Abe, I want to get your opinion on this, because my take is that a lot of this was totally unnecessary. When it came to first the Rules Committee, where a really modest faction of Republicans had decided that they were going to try and impose on the party some sort of chaos in the form of allowing unbinding. There were two measures that were before the Rules Committee. One would have unbound the candidates, or the delegates rather, to vote for the winner of their party or their caucus, or rather the primary of their caucus. And another was a quote-unquote conscience clause, which was to allow delegates to be allowed to vote in however they felt would satisfy their conscientious objections. In both cases, both measures failed. They failed in the debate process. They moved for cloture, and we got one roll call vote for the conscience clause, which showed that only 12 people stood up in support of it. Out of a 112 member committee, you need 28. There was just nothing there. And what they wanted in this Rules Committee was a full roll call vote on the motion itself. And they didn't get it. The chair said, you know what, we're not going to give it to you. And that's kind of a strong arm move. It was designed to shield the members of that committee from having to stand up and put identities and faces and names to who was supportive of that measure. It probably would have exactly mirrored the vote for cloture. But they didn't want it. They didn't want that to happen. And so there was bad blood. And bad blood stayed around all weekend long until Monday, when this whole package of rules that was agreed to in this committee was up for a vote before all the delegates, all 20 some odd hundred of them. And you need a majority, which is 1280-something, to pass this package forward. And there was, again, a very modest revolt against this rules package designed to just vote it down. And they knew they were going to fail. They didn't have the numbers to succeed. They had enough numbers to get a minority report to the floor, which was 9 states, something like that. And so they got their motion heard, and the chair called a voice vote. And there was this blaring din in the hall. All the no's were screaming, all the ayes were screaming. In the opinion of the chair, the ayes had it. And the crowd exploded again. And so they wanted to just keep this voice vote as just the voice vote. And they couldn't possibly have heard who was who. So what was appropriate at that time was to call for a point of order and have a roll call vote. And the chair just left, just walked off the stage. And so for 20 minutes, the anti-Trump forces held held control of the proceedings. They had every microphone. Mike Lee, who is a very prominent opponent of Donald Trump's nomination, was giving interviews to whoever was interviewing him. He had control over proceedings, basically. Him and former Virginia gubernatorial candidate Ken Cuccinelli, who's also a Trump opponent. When they finally came back, the chair announced that three states of these nine had dropped out, and there was no need to have a roll call vote. So once again, ayes and nays, screams, the ayes have it, and the motion failed. Once again, the RNC could have humiliated the anti-Trump faction. And once again, they added fuel to the fire by handling it really, really poorly. And finally, yesterday, when you had the vote that resulted in Donald Trump's nomination, once again, there were efforts to have some sort of roll call votes, or allow at least the delegates who were awarded to other candidates, notably Marco Rubio, John Kasich, and Ted Cruz, to be counted as such. And there were states where there were no, states or territories rather, where there were no votes for Donald Trump, like Washington, D.C. Now, the rules stay that if there's only one candidate who's entered into the nominating process legitimately, there's only one candidate who's going to get votes. So when D.C. said, we have 7 votes for Ted Cruz and 11 votes for Marco Rubio, the chair counted them all for Donald Trump. And that's in the rules, and that's totally fine. But once again, it created a whole bunch of bad blood. Iowa and Virginia delegations walked out, and the result was a lot of unnecessary hostility and frustration with Donald Trump in a very heavy-handed fashion that demonstrated that the Republican establishment was totally behind Donald Trump, and Donald Trump is a creation of the quote-unquote Republican establishment, and it was all very unnecessary, in my opinion. Maybe I'm being a little too hard on the RNC.
No, I don't think so. I think in a broad way, it goes to show what I think we've seen time and again since the beginning of this election season, which is that the chaos and incoherence around Trump, around the Trump candidacy, is contagious, and whoever signs on catches it. As opposed to the hope of the RNC, which was the reverse, that they would be able to instill some sense of order and coherence on Trump, it necessarily works the other way. The incoherence flows outward. You know, and also the anti-Trump faction also, I think what they wanted was to have a roll call vote to get people on record in the event of a Trump loss, and to say, okay, this is how things.
This is where the purge starts.
Yes. Well, this is, well, just so we know, you know, and it was a noble idea, no good. So, no, I don't think you're being too harsh at all.
Well, there's always, I guess, hope springs eternal. That's the one word you hear from reluctant Trump supporters. I'm thinking specifically of Marco Rubio, that there's always hope that he's going to change. It's like the battered girlfriend syndrome, where he's going to be this other person eventually, and all you have to do is hang in long enough to get there. And as you said, he corrupts the institutions around him, rather than him changing, he changes everything else, in many cases for the worse. As we move forward into the general election season, and that theme is going to carry forward into our next issue, by the way. But as we move forward into the general election season, I'm wondering if you think that he'll be able to be disciplined enough to not force the Republican Party to go picking up after him every time he creates one of these controversies. And we're about to go into another one of those unnecessary controversies that has dominated this week, which should be a gimme free throw week. But whether or not the party is going to eventually say, okay, 2016 is a loss, and we're going to have to start to cut bait here.
I mean, we certainly could be heading into that situation down the line. I mean, that's not going to, certainly not going to happen in the midst of the convention. Yeah. But no, I don't, I think, not only do I think he's resistant to discipline, I think it, aside from reading the occasional booster opinion piece that says he's there, this long fabled pivot is here or coming or just about here, There's something in the convention speeches to me that almost seemed to inherently acknowledge that he's not going to change. It's in fact part of why so many speakers seem not really to be focusing on him, and why the theme of last night, for example, was Hillary Clinton.
Right, which was supposed to be economics and joblessness, and it just sort of became Hillary.
Yes. So I don't think, you know, and why the endorsements that we're hearing during the convention are really these sort of broad, mythical statements from Ultimate Fighting champion presidents, right, and from family members, and there's nothing, no one's really seems to, as far as I can recall, get up there and say, listen, he's you may think he's brash, you may think he's a loudmouth and so forth, but no, he is reasonable, he is disciplined when he needs to be, he's, you know, no one seems to really overtly be making this pivot case.
I'm going to push back on that a little bit, because I think you're absolutely right about yesterday. There was something very strange going on with those speeches, actually, that I want to get your opinion on. But the first day, in my opinion, was the thematic of that day was, it was supposed to be Make America Safe Again, all about national security. But what it was, what I heard constantly, consistently from these speakers was, Donald Trump is not who you think he is. He's everything, there's all these things that you've heard about him, and he's not that. He's a family man, he's a wonderful, warm, kind, generous person, he's a charitable person, though he doesn't want to ever get credit for it, which strains credulity. But that's what I heard. I heard yesterday was Donald Trump is the person that, he's not the person you think he is, and yesterday, or rather Monday, and then the day after yesterday was, remember you hate Hillary, remember that.
I think you're actually 100% right, yeah. But none of it was specific about policy and about his ability to be disciplined or serious exactly. It was his kindness, his generosity, his ambition, things of that nature. Yeah.
One of the things I want to get your opinion on as kind of a digression is yesterday's speeches that did focus on Hillary. A lot of them were really good. Prosecutorial, dispassionate indictments of Hillary Clinton. Moving all the way into Chris Christie's speech, however, all of them seemed to fall flat. You had, I'm thinking very specifically of former Attorney General Mukasey, who made a rather kind of bland, but nevertheless really effective indictment of Hillary Clinton. Now, maybe it was speaking style, but it struck me that that audience didn't want to hear anything that wasn't praise of Donald Trump explicitly or red meat. And when it had to do with Hillary Clinton, it just sort of fell flat. Ron Johnson, senator from Wisconsin, got up there and said something to that effect. It just kind of bombed. Until Chris Christie got up there and really threw the bloody tunic into the crowd, did they begin to respond to an anti-Hillary case. But it had to be a pro-Trump case, too.
The thing about Mike Mukasey's speech is that I thought it was, content-wise, it was excellent. But obviously when you lay out this sort of legalistic, lapidary case like that, an auditorium is not necessarily the most receptive place for it. Strangely, while Chris Christie's speech was very well received, I think in its own way it fell flat, in that there's this phenomenon whereby sometimes you lay out a case that's been hinted at beforehand, and even if you yell it and even if you present it in a clever way, there's a sort of automatic human response to go, that's it? That's sort of all it is? Not that I think Hillary Clinton isn't deserving of a harsh judgment on some of the things he laid out and additional things. But there was something about it that was so very seeking. You know, it was a sort of mock trial without really being a mock trial. It was in some ways the opposite of the James Comey statement. It was, she's guilty, not really going to tell you why. I'm just going to sort of allude to it.
Well, like you said, I mean, that's appropriate for that kind of venue. I mean, the left has been just aghast with the impropriety of Republicans daring to chant lock her up as though she's not a figure in considerable trouble, not just and was very much facing a criminal indictment, but is currently now facing a civil case about these emails, which has a much lower evidentiary threshold and very well could result in some sort of judgment against her. But it's not as though that this is sort of untoward for this format. It's a rally. It's a rally full of partisans, and Democrats are just as guilty of Republicans of engaging in excess. Now, is it kind of ugly? Yeah, I think so. I don't think it's very becoming behavior, but there is sort of a reptilian brain that takes over when you're in that sort of format, and certain allowances, I suppose, should be made for that situation, as long as they don't go into something that's a little bit more physical. So I kind of find those criticisms to be a bit far-fetched, with the exception of verging on incitement, or as one pro-Trump delegate said today, that Hillary Clinton is treasonous to the point where she is deserving of capital punishment in the form of a firing squad. That's not healthy. That kind of fanaticism, and encouraging that kind of fanaticism, is a sign of a very sick political movement. And I don't know whether or not we should be encouraging that. But the notion that crowd chanting "lock her up" is beyond the pale, is really just a contrivance on the part of the left.
Yeah, I wasn't. It's not that I was terribly offended by it, but I do think that at a certain point, a performance like Christie's does reveal a slight stink of desperation too. It's, I mean, as overwhelming sort of loud arguments can do. And I think there was something of that there, because it was long too. It was lengthy, and you know, and when do we hear Chris Christie talking about, you know, Nigeria and
oh,
and
whatever, you know. What was really insulting was the suggestion that from a Trump endorser that Hillary Clinton was unduly lenient towards Vladimir Putin. I mean, that's just takes a lot of brass. But yeah, he was also kind of showing Donald Trump, you know, what he was missing, so to speak, because he very much, according to reports, was really disappointed that he wasn't chosen for vice president, and he wanted to show him what got away. And I think he accomplished that, because it was very much in the Trump persona, with an exception of the fact that it's very bizarre that the Trump primary campaign issues have kind of melted away. Where is all the, you know, bombastic talk about building 30-story walls on the Rio Grande? Where is the Muslim ban? Any incarnation of the Muslim ban that has been, you know, pared back over the course of a year? Where is all this stuff that he was so proud to campaign on in the primary, and now nobody's talking about it in the general? I suppose that's something of a pivot, the pivot that's been long awaited, but, you know, it's sort of a sotto voce pivot. We're not exactly embracing softer tone or softer rhetoric. We're just sort of jettisoning these really unworkable nonsense proposals that appeal to our basest instincts.
And there's also no reason to think that when the convention's over, we'll hear the nonsense all over again and in new colorful forms. I mean,
yeah. Well, anyway, speaking of controversies that are unnecessary and don't need to be, as it were, for during the convention week. The flap of the week that has really dominated news cycles, and shouldn't be, by all rights, has been Melania Trump's speech, and whether or not there was a passage there that was plagiarized from a 2008 Democratic National Convention address by now First Lady Michelle Obama. In that speech, Melania's speech, was, in my opinion, and a lot of other opinions, I'm leaning on the breadth of opinion on this point, very good. She delivered it cleverly and well. English is not her first language, and teleprompter reading is a learned skill, and she performed both exceptionally well. She came up after Rudy Giuliani, who wowed conservatives, in my opinion. It was a little bombastic and a little theatrical. And, you know, I could tell that I was being appealed to, and that was something of a turnoff. Whereas Melania had a unifying message, a general election message. They pushed the schedule around to get her into prime time, knowing that she was going to be something of a draw. And I think she hit it out of the park. And then an hour later, some enterprising journalist sitting in a Starbucks, unemployed, decided to go back and check the record, check these speeches back against each other, and sure enough, the similarities were eerie to the point of strained credulity to suggest that there weren't intentional efforts to lift some of that speech from Michelle Obama. Now, that didn't have to be a scandal either, but the Trump campaign really leaned into making that a scandal. Their approach to it was contradictory and self-destructive and shifting and fueling this media fire and this controversy. And the right has, the pro-Trump right has been saying, this is a mountain out of a molehill. This is nothing. This is a media controversy. They made it up from nowhere. They should just let it go and ignore it. But it wasn't the media that was making this thing. It was the Trump campaign that every hour on the hour and the Republicans in the committee were feeding this and giving new details and creating a new excuse and a new culprit and then giving somebody, you know, an out, and then that out would refuse to be thrown under the bus. The process started that evening where they said, you know, there was no plagiarism at all. And then they said, okay, well, Melania wrote the whole thing herself. She's never written a speech in her life, nor much
less
given one.
Well, she had essentially said that. She said she... Beforehand, she had said that it was her doing, and she had a little input, but
okay, well, that wasn't true, because it turned out that there was some actual veteran speechwriters who wrote the thing and were supposed to assume their positions under the bus and declined to do it.
Well, the thing about Melania's original, about using her statement before the fact like that is that either it wasn't true, so either she was lying and she didn't write the speech, or she was telling the truth, and therefore she had cribbed it.
Right. And then I think that was before or after. I'm not entirely clear on my timeline here, but at some point, Republican National Committee spokesperson Sean Spicer sort of self-immolated when he went on television and decided to say that, you know, the choice of words here, which were so inane and kind of like vapid and you know, about just being the best you can be and working really hard. That My Little Pony's Sparkle Pony, Sparkle Twilight Pony, or whoever the pony is, had said it just as much. I mean, that's how silly that this controversy was, according to Sean Spicer. Well, it turns out that this speech was cribbed, and it was written by somebody who's a very close Trump associate with the Trump Organization, who has written, ghostwritten, and co-written a lot of Trump books. And she tendered her resignation today, her mistake, it was an accidental on her quote-unquote part, lifting this part of the speech from Michelle Obama. And she offered her resignation, a resignation which was nobly declined. Donald Trump refused to accept that resignation. So now we're in day three of this controversy, but wait, it gets better. The resignation that was tendered was written on a piece of Trump Organization stationery. Now, that may seem like nothing to most people and seemed like nothing to me, because the Trump Organization and the Trump campaign are so closely linked that there's almost no moiety between either of them, and it's very hard to tell when one stops and the other begins, so I kind of overlooked it. But people who know this regulations and federal election rules better than I do noted that that could very well be a violation of federal law, that they might have broken the law by intermingling Trump's business interests with the campaign and a specific campaign-related function like the Republican National Convention, and that could very well be adjudicated.
But, of course, we shouldn't make too much over a piece of letterhead. I mean, you know, one has to know what the connection is beyond that and how her employment is organized.
Yeah, I'm not speaking to the legality there because I don't know.
Right.
And I could be totally off base here. I'm only going off what other people who are in this industry have said. But the very fact that we have to talk about whether or not this was a legal violation is, again, fueling the controversy fire. This should be a cakewalk week. No, it's very hard to mess up convention week.
No, it's an astounding cascade of own goals on the Trump campaign's part over this speech. I mean, if you think of all the ways that Melania's speech could have gone wrong, she's not used to this. No one's used to this. No one's used to getting out in front of that kind of crowd, making some sort of quasi-personal statement about your husband, English is not her first language. She could have, her accent could have come off wrong. She could have been problematically nervous. None of that happened. She killed it. But there was then this problem, and it points to so many sort of defining weaknesses in the Trump campaign. Competence is out, you know, and you know, he had made a show of sort of saying, look how I can run a campaign so lean. There's too much waste, and as an example of how not to waste. Look at how my campaign doesn't waste. And it turns out, well, you might have done well to waste a little more on a piece of software that looks for plagiarism or a few more writers or something.
That's a really
along
good
those
point.
Lines. And then, yeah, as you said, we woke up yesterday to a sort of full kind of meltdown mode from the Trump camp, and now it keeps getting better, and really is so far overshadowing most of the rest of the convention.
Yeah.
It's the issue.
And look, the press has a vested interest. I think it's fair to say that there is an interest in a narrative here. That is, the Trump campaign is a raging dumpster fire, and they want to cover that. I think they don't want to upset that narrative. That's beginning to congeal, and I think they're invested in it. So the Trump campaign shouldn't be feeding that fire. If you're a conservative, you know that there's no media invested interest in your success. Whether or not that's fair, that's something that we've all come to accept over the course of the last couple of decades. And conservatives would know that. Your job is to put out fires. And the Trump campaign is under the impression, which frankly Chris Christie was under at a certain point, that the media is on his side. And I think that's led to a lot of poor assumptions on his choice and carelessness and sloppiness. And that's starting to come back to bite him.
Oh, well, can I say one thing that I think they've done correctly at the convention, since we're
sure.
You know, talking about the various problems with it? I think their use of sort of showbiz visual technology and Trump's being this hovering presence that sort of appears in silhouettes and then comes up momentarily on a jumbotron. I actually think in his case it kind of works.
Yeah.
It projects
the entrance on
yes.
Monday got a lot of attention.
Why yes.
Just describe that and if you haven't seen it.
Yeah, he sort of emerged. I don't know if he was even announced or not when it happened. I feel like he wasn't, because it was that kind of moment. His sort of silhouette appeared in a kind of misty haze on the stage, sort of unmistakably, you know, his silhouette, and then he came out from the dark and introduced Melania. And it was the sort of the high point before disaster struck.
The wall opened up, he was backlit with a dry ice smoke over the ground.
Yeah. Now, of course,
and then the teleprompter and the lectern emerged from the stage as he walked forward. It's very much a WWE thing. We feel like he should have come out with
entirely
a
belt. And of course, it's the kind of thing that if anyone tries to do it after this, they will look terrible and horrible.
Or before, nobody else could have pulled that off.
Right. But you know, this sort of shameless showbiz stuff is his métier, and not shying away from that, I think, in his case, is sort of helped him.
Well, to be critical again, there are elements to this of good showmanship, and there are a lot that aren't. This convention has been characterized as John Podhoretz has noted on the blog, and you can go read his dispatches. They're really great, really informative, and they're live from the floor of the convention. He's, and I can paraphrase him a little bit, that he's shocked at the joylessness and the listlessness of this convention. He's speaking at normal decibel levels on the floor, where he's never been able to do that before. You see images now two nights in a row of a convention that is two-thirds empty, where people are streaming out of the exits as primetime speakers are speaking. Something is not normal here, and I don't know what, but something is creating the impression, and I think I'm going to paraphrase my former Salem communications colleague Guy Benson, who's been saying that it feels like you're at a game in the third quarter in the middle of a blowout loss. There is just no passion, no enthusiasm. A sense of dread and inevitability has come over this convention. with the exception of some hardcores who you see on C-SPAN dancing and doing a, you know, a conga line, the rest of them, they do feel a little bit muted, like they know what the future holds.
Well, I mean, and how could it really be otherwise? It's sort of packed with B and C and D listers, and it's completely divided and turned against itself, as you pointed out, and it's been plagued with really embarrassing mistakes.
So we go into day three. This, as we speak this evening, is Vice Presidential nominee Mike Pence will be addressing the convention. He's probably going to be introduced by Donald Trump or Speaker Ryan or both. And then the next day, Donald Trump formally accepts the nomination, even though the RNC is already calling him the nominee. So it's kind of a formality. But that's the convention. Now, what we've not seen here is unity. And I don't think we're going to see it, particularly because nobody seems interested in it. You have the Bush campaign, the Bush family, which is presenting sort of like a shadow government to adopt a Britishism. They're really out there saying that, you know, this is not the party that we're used to or that we're going to support. Donald Trump's campaign has recklessly antagonized John Kasich over the course of this process. Over the course of this entire affair, Kasich has refused to give his imprimatur to this nomination, and as a result, you have Trump campaign and Donald Trump himself, people going on television and attacking Kasich's performance in the primaries and his state. And whether or not, you know, you think that it's appropriate for John Kasich to do what he's doing, this is entirely self-destructive on the part of the Trump campaign. They need Ohio to win, and you cannot win Ohio without the Ohio Republican machine. And the Ohio Republican chairman is going after Donald Trump, and the governor, the most really popular governor in that state, is vocally against Donald Trump. If they don't get any support from the machine in the state, they're going to lose. And you had some interesting observations, considering that we had a report this morning in the New York Times that suggested that there's a little bit of backstory, a little bit of history to this this mutual antipathy.
Yeah, there was a report in the Times this morning that I believe it was Donald Jr. Approached Kasich some time back and approached Kasich and said something to the effect of, how would you like to be the most powerful vice president in history? And Kasich said, well, what does that exactly entail?
Right.
And
presiding over the Senate
once in a while? And Donald Jr. said, well, you would be in charge of domestic and foreign policy. And Kasich said, well, then what would your father do? And Donald said, I don't know, but make America great again. I like that report because it strikes me as very believable and as sort of one of the best predictive sort of data points for analysis of what a possible Trump presidency would look like. You know, that he would be this sort of Oz-like figure, this figurehead, this really a titular president, and have policy makers just doing their thing, and he'd be entirely detached from it. I think there's something to that. It also speaks to the idea that they did approach Kasich after all. So where is the famous sort of extremism and harshness that has characterized Trump so far?
Well, they did know he was a valuable political figure. I mean, it's hard not to. He was performing extremely well in the polls of a general election vis-a-vis Hillary Clinton. And they know exactly how much weight he carries in Ohio. That's why they're so frustrated with him. There's sort of something of a jilted relationship here at this point. But I think that's true, and I don't want to step on your point, but I think it's a very good one you made earlier about whether or not, you know, this is a portent of fascism descending on the United States, where it's you know, if they're going after John Kasich and all they want to do is go to parties and do interviews and play golf.
Right, right. They're going after Kasich, and they sort of want to give him the keys to the kingdom. You know, he can mind the shop.
Right.
Yeah. So no, that's why I think the fascist stuff is a little off.
By the way, is not how this works. You can't just hand the presidency off to the vice president. That's not allowed. But yeah, and it's also the most tangible evidence that we have so far that Donald Trump really has no interest in being president. He wants to win the presidency, but he has zero interest in governing as president. He just wants to, you know, be important and not be laughed at anymore.
Yeah, I mean, if he hasn't boned up on what he would need to have boned up on to sound credible as a nominee, he's certainly not going to go so far as to do the work to actually be a president and commander in chief. I mean, that's at least not in his own mind. That's not his plan.
Well, we don't know. Let's assume that this report is true. Then I think it speaks probably pretty well of John Kasich. It's certainly a heady thing to be offered basically the presidency without having to work for it, and to deny that offer does speak well of him. It speaks of some restraint. And if looking forward to 2020, in the event that Donald Trump does not win the presidency, there will be a race to succeed him. And right now, the clearest distinctions between those people who will try to succeed him are going to be those who endorsed and embraced Donald Trump and those who did not. And John Kasich has certainly staked out a claim to be as much the head, if not the indisputed leader, of the camp who did not. Looking forward to the rest of the convention week and next week. If this was a normal campaign, and it's not, but let's say it's a normal campaign, we should see Donald Trump do pretty well in the polls in the beginning of the Democratic convention week starting next week. So by the time we're here, a week from today, we should have a pretty good idea whether or not this is a normal convention. I still expect a polling bump for Donald Trump. Something average, something like Mitt Romney's convention bump, maybe 3 or 4 points. And I anticipate that a lot of that will be fueled by Republicans who come home after this process. I think there will be very few anti-Trump Republican holdouts. There are always going to be members of the intellectual movement who are resistant to that, but I don't think they make up the majority of the base. I expect them to gain close to the support of 90% of registered Republicans. And that should fuel a healthy, decent bump. And Hillary Clinton is having a terrible week, terrible month. She's been unable to stop the bleeding since her press conference in which she was rhetorically indicted by FBI Director James Comey. And she doesn't know what she's doing. She's flailing. She's not sure how to make this thing stop. So those two things combined, we could have a scenario in which we have a couple of polls, real reputable polls, that show Donald Trump taking the lead, maybe getting into the 43-44% range while Hillary Clinton's 42-41, something like that, prompting pundit apoplexy. But we also expect Hillary Clinton will get her own bump because Democrats will do the same thing. They'll have a healthy unifying convention. Everybody will come back together and we'll be probably where we were by Labor Day.
Well, and I suspect her bump will be bigger. than
a lot of people
Trump's
say
bump.
That.
I mean,
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think there'll be a sort of, you know, modest to average bump here, but no one. We weren't shown anything. People weren't shown anything that they didn't expect to be shown, and therefore they're going to sign on in a way they wouldn't have before. Other than okay, this is reality. This is the fact. This is the nominee. And I may be
overestimating the amount of bad blood that was left over the course of this whole chaotic convention scenario. I'm anticipating that nobody saw that, and those who did don't really care. But I could be completely underestimating the impact. That heavy-handed display of force on the part of the party for Donald Trump could have on committed Ted Cruz supporters, committed Marco Rubio supporters, John Kasich supporters. They might have a bad taste in their mouth even still. But I am anticipating that after, you know, a couple of these speeches, that everybody comes around to Donald Trump.
And it also depends on Trump's performance, which, you know, we've yet to see. And as John Podhoretz has pointed out on the blog, How is he going to react to the Melania speech scandal? Is he going to lash out in anger because she was picked on, or and because no one in his camp sort of handled it correctly? I don't know. You know, see, if he gives some sort of characteristic unhinged speech, that's gonna hurt.
I think you're right. So we will just have to see. But with that, I think we're gonna close out this episode of the Commentary Magazine podcast. Commentary Magazine has been a leading light, one of the leading journals of intellectual opinion and insight for 71 years. You can read all of our material on the blog at commentarymagazine.com. You can also subscribe for $19.99 per year, or a little bit more than that for the print edition and for a print magazine in your home. We will be back next week with John Podhoretz, who's going to have a lot of insights from the convention floor, and you will not want to miss that episode. In the meantime, keep the candle burning.